Just a quick warning that we will be discussing heavy themes like pregnancy loss, abortion, religion, suicide, abusive dynamics, and as always, the big existential questions. This is an unbleeped version of our thoughts as they come to us.
Hello and welcome to A Hopeless Endeavor, a Joanna Newsom podcast. This is part one-ish of Only Skin, because this song is not only the longest on the album, hitting almost 17 minutes, but is a song that is very dear to both of our hearts. My name is Sam. I live in Vancouver.
And I'm Nikki. I live in Ithaca in upstate New York.
I think this is the song that I have listened to more than any other. It's a song that I've gone back to over and over and over again. It's a song that I used to use to track distance between places. So it's a big one, not only in its length, in its depth, in its lyrics. It's just an incredible, insurmountable mountain we are climbing here. So
That's such a good way of describing it. It's an insurmountable mountain. Like, if it, I know we've used this word previously, but like, if there was ever an appropriate time to use the word epic to describe a song, like, this is it. It's so fucking epic.
Yeah, this one very much to me feels like we are slowly crawling through a labyrinth of dreams, and we are very much climbing up and sliding down. There's so many peaks and valleys. She brings us so high and we fall so deep. It's a big one.
It's a big one. And I was talking to Sam before we started recording, and I was saying that, like, Only Skin's a pretty controversial song on the Facebook groups that I am a part of, the Joanna Newsom ones on Facebook, because some people, like, feel the way that Sam and I do about Only Skin, where, like, we feel like it's just such a fucking masterpiece. And then other people kind of hate it, or at least they think that it's the least good song on East.
Which blows my mind. Like, Nikki texted me today when I was on, like, my 3-hour walk listening to this on loop, and I stopped in my tracks because I had never considered that there's an opinion other than this is the most amazing song on the album. But I get it in the way that, like, it's maybe not as straightforward as the other songs. It doesn't really have a real beginning or a middle or an end. And even after researching it in depth, at least the first 6 minutes for the last week and a half, like, I don't feel like I understand it nearly as well as Monkey and Bear, Sawdust and Diamonds, or Emily.
Yeah, me too.
So yeah, I get it. But I'm in it.
It's not accessible.
Yeah, it's not. Exactly. Yeah, maybe it's just not as accessible as the other ones are.
So we should just dive right in because there's just no other way to start. But holy shit, this is an intimidating process. Okay, yeah. So some preliminary marks, I guess, about Only Skin before we get right into the lyrics. So I had noted that I wanted to, I feel like I might have said this before when we were just talking about, like, in our first episode, like, general themes throughout East, but I can't remember, so I'm just going to say it again, that she said in multiple interviews that this album was about 3 or 4 big events that happen in her life. So sometimes in some interviews she says it's about 3, and then in some interviews she says it's about 4. Right. So it's, I don't know, whatever, one of the two. And then she said that Only Skin is kind of an attempt to piece all of those events together. So it is like a deliberate attempt to try to, like, fuse together all of the themes and events that are happening throughout East. And I feel like it feels like that too, like, not only because of its length, but because of its themes. And then, like you said, Sam, like, the peaks and the valleys. Okay. So that was my first tidbit.
I pulled a lot, or I tried to pull, maybe not for this first part of the song, but I pulled a lot from two Blessing of the Birds, Blessing All the Birds posts. The first titled Be a Woman, Female Sexuality and Femininity in Only Skin. And the second, That's an Awfully Real Gun, Only Skin and the Destructive and Life-Giving Facets of Sex, both of which are an incredible read. And I think in reading those posts, one of the most important takeaways for the song as a whole is just the idea that the female narrator is constantly and consistently questioning if pleasure is ultimately always harmful, while at the same time calling out and condemning the misogyny that surrounds her experience of pleasure. The song also just feels like the entire expanse of a relationship. Like it's something that's alive, it thrives, it gives, it takes, it crumbles, it builds itself back up. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. So thank you very much to Melissa Marciano and Rachel Parent for their amazing insights.
Yes. We did get a lovely submission from Alexis. And one of the points that she submitted was this incredible poem by Anne Morrow Lindbergh. And I'll just read it quickly here because I think it's kind of just a beautiful thing to keep in mind as we move throughout the song. So the submission that Alexis sent in was, when you love someone, you do not love them all the time in exactly the same way from moment to moment. It is an impossibility. It is even a lie to pretend to. And yet this is exactly what most of us demand. We have so little faith in the ebb and flow of life, of love, of relationships. We leap at the flow of the tide and resist in terror its ebb. We are afraid it will never return. We insist on permanency, on duration, on continuity, when the only continuity possible in life, as in love, is in growth, in fluidity, in freedom, in the sense that the dancers are free, barely touching as they pass, but partners in the same pattern. The only real security is not in owning or possessing, not in demanding or expecting, not in hoping even. Security is a relationship. Security in a relationship lies neither in looking back to what it was in nostalgia nor forward to what it may be in dread or anticipation, but living in the present relationship and accepting it as it is now. Relationships must be like islands. One must accept them for what they are here and now within their limits, islands surrounded and interrupted by the sea and continually visited and abandoned by the tides. And again, that was by Anne Morrow Lindbergh. So thank you so much, Alexis.
Thank you, Alexis. And yeah, I really love that. And it really does feel only skinny in its.
Oh, I love that verb.
Only skinny. It's a good one. Only skinny, except for not like thin, because just no.
Of the skin. Yeah.
Of the skin. It feels of the skin. yeah, just like in the like ebbs and flows part in particular, like how that evokes both water and like the relationship ebbing and flowing. And then actually, as you said too before, like Sam, like even the musicality of the song almost comes in waves. Like it like.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
It's like watery in its, in this like meta way somehow.
I did also read another, not super related, but kind of generally related, Blessing All the Bird post titled The Binaries in Joanna's Corpus, Man versus Woman. And it was Melissa who authored this one. And it kind of highlighted the ability that Joanna has to explore like the dichotomy of gender as a binary that brings real pain, not only to the female narrators, but also, and this is a direct quote, pain and punishment for both those who adhere to the standards the binary establishes for femininity and for those who deviate. Melissa draws these amazing connections between the slut-shaming of the female narrator in Only Skin by the common folk and the sexual manipulation and emotional ridicule of Bear in Monkey and Bear, which concludes, as we know, with Bear's pleasure in not only escaping the work she was forced to endure, but with pleasure in food and eating. Oh, and in reading this, I should have texted you, Nikki, but I did not. I was upset at the end of Monkey and Bear when we were talking about those goddamn minnows.
Yes, yeah.
But this article in particular, this paper really made me rethink my reaction to that. And instead kind of reframe it as Bear receiving that meal. The line is, now her coat drags through the water, begging with a life's worth of hunger, limitless minnows. And made me think of like someone who is literally starving, someone who has undergone extensive trauma, and how your body can't handle that huge meal. Like you can't handle, Bear can't handle a whole ass salmon. She can't.
Yeah.
So to kind of give herself those small bites, those small meals at a time is almost like a form of release, like a form of self-care maybe for Bear. And it allows her maybe like the space to truly care for herself and to give herself what she needs, regardless if the ending of the song is a suicide or whatever.
Yeah.
I just, yeah, had some.
That's cool. What made you rethink it?
I think just the idea of like, you know, it is Bear finally allowing herself to feel pleasure, and like the fact that she didn't go overboard with it, the fact that she treated herself with real respect was really in like really in contrast to a lot of what was happening in the song.
I like that too. You've brought me to like both sides of that, because when you first said it, I was like, oh yeah, you're right, like minnows are just like a paltry dish. But now you're right, it's kind of like if they're limitless, she's like easing herself back into
exactly and she's taking her damn time, which I like she's not overfilling herself, she's not feasting, because she knows that would hurt. Like if your body's literally starving, you can't do that to yourself. You can't eat a giant meal
famine,
because you will die. It's too much.
Right.
And maybe self-care isn't the right word. Maybe it's just like her first ability to like show self-respect or something like
just
that.
Just actually take care of herself.
Without like being under monkey's eye.
Yes. Yeah. Of food that isn't like doled out or regulated.
Exactly.
Or like
it's her choice.
Monkey. It's her choice. Yeah.
So bless you, Bear. Your choice. Bless you, Bear. Do what you got to do. I'm sorry I was so upset.
Oh, Bear.
Yeah. Ugh. But okay. Also, she deserves the salmon. Like,
she deserves the salmon. She'll get there. Eventually gets
it. Yeah.
She stretches out her tummy a little bit. Okay. And I also wanted to mention 2 to 3 more things.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
2 things. In one of the interviews that I read at the very beginning of prepping for this podcast, I just went back to those notes, and she had mentioned, as I like have said on previous episodes, that Only Skin was one of those songs that she wrote knowing that she was going to have orchestration on. And I think that like, if you were just to have to guess, if you didn't know anything about what song she wrote with orchestration in mind, I feel like Only Skin is one of those that you'd be like, yeah, no, that it's not just like a coincidence that it happens to be so amenable to orchestration. Like it just is, it feels like its substance lies mostly in the orchestration, like musically.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting, something to keep in mind. And then also, because of Av's helpful suggestion that we should talk a little bit more, when we can at least, about the musicality, Sam had sent me this, like, I don't even know what the adjective is for it. Like, just
immense,
fucking
like
immense, 136, I think you said, Sam, essay about all of Ys. And it's really about, like, the musicality of Ys, but a lot of it is too technical for us to even touch.
Yeah,
but one part that I read,
the author is Rachel Hoddle, and this was just found with, like, who knows what the Google search combination was to get here. Like, it could have been any of the thousands of things that I was looking up, but it came to us.
And then just like Sam, you had said this before too, but like it feels like overwhelming to even try to get into fully, because we just don't know like these technical musical terms. But one thing that I was able to glean from it was that they were saying like that this song is in a very like Newsom-like way rounded. So in that, let's see here, she says the reprise of the F section precedes, and then there's a new section that like is very similar. So I guess the idea is just that there's like some kind of like cyclicalness where like it starts in a very similar way as it ends. I'm sure I'm not describing that right. I don't know the technical stuff, but I thought that like just completely and wholly deferring to someone who knows something about music, that they're indicating that there's some sort of similarity between the way that the song begins and ends, I thought was cool. So I thought that I would just want to note that before we started.
Totally. And I did try to, on my very long walks today, try and pay attention to, and I think maybe more than the other songs, the musicality of Only Skin plays a lot more. Like, I think we said this before we started recording, but this song more than, I don't want to say any other song of hers, but maybe more than any other song of hers, the feelings that you get, that I get while I'm listening to this song, almost makes, like, the musicality of it is so strong that even without the lyrics, I'm with her. Like, I'm in the dream, I'm in the story. Even I think if the lyrics were not included, you'd be feeling some big feels as you listened.
I totally agree. And you would feel those ebbs and flows. Like, you would be in it. There's still a story that's being told just with the music underneath.
Yes, very much so. To emphasize certain points, to de-emphasize certain points, to bring you from place to place, in and out of dreams.
In and out of dreams for sure. And like the hopefulness slash like the despondency.
Totally.
Franticness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on.
All right. Are you ready to dive in?
I'm ready, and I have my official lyrics this week, so I will be reading from those as well.
Perfect.
So our first verse is, "And there was a booming above you. That night, black airplanes flew over the sea, and they were lowing and shifting like beached whales, shelled snails, as you strained and you squinted to see the retreat of their hairless and blind cavalry." I know we've mentioned this before, but this entire ballad, this entire epic song starts with a conjunction, and kind of suggests that we as the audience or as participants or as listeners enter in the middle of something. And also very much, I think, in a dreamlike state. Like, right away, we are thrust in the middle of something. Are we on a beach? We can hear the booming. We can see these low-flying, giant black airplanes just hovering over the sea. So I feel like more than other songs, we are right involved. There's no slow introduction. There's no here's one character and here's another. We just are.
Yeah. I really like, just as you were speaking, it like occurred to me for the first time that, like, you know how sometimes with dreams, like, you'll be like, for some reason I was just like in this house with these people and we were doing this, but you're thrust right into it, as in like it there's no like logical beginning to your dreams. You just like remember all of a sudden being in this scene without there being like a clear beginning. So I think that might be one indication that a dream is happening here. I went back and forth today, just doing my research. I was like, is this a dream or is this like just a metaphor for the war that is happening within the person's head, perhaps? The you in this, the second person. Yeah, so I'm not sure, but I did have two things to note, I guess, about the, how did you say it, Sam? In medias res?
Mm-hmm. I believe so.
Yeah. So just that term that, again, just means like just to be, it's like a literary term, rhetorical term, to be like thrust into the middle of things. I was reading on Genius that there's sort of a tradition of doing this, particularly with epic poems. And so I read that Homer's Odyssey, I believe, does this. And then also that Ezra Pound's Cantos starts, I wrote this all down. So he says, "And then went down to the ships, set keel to breaker," blah, blah, blah. He keeps going. But he starts with an and then he invokes ship imagery. And here Joanne is invoking, obviously, like, sky imagery, right? But the same sort of, like, fleets of machines. Mm-hmm. And it just, I, there's a couple of things here that made me think, especially in this first part of the song, that brought me back to when we were talking about Emily, sort of like the reflection of the sky, like shit that goes on in the sky is also happening on Earth, or it is like mirrored in some way.
Right.
It's like kind of like an existentially vibe. So I kind of got that like sense from her, perhaps maybe using planes instead of the ships that that are invoked by Pound.
I think that musically, at least for me, when I was doing my listens and listens and listens today, the orchestra brings us in quite calmly. While I was walking, I had written, like, it really is like a fairy tale. Like, we're being presented with this tale or this story very gently and very sweetly, even if immediately like the visuals are not gentle or sweet. I feel like the way she's introducing it very much is.
Oh, it's interesting that you say that. I feel like I kind of got the opposite impression, maybe, but maybe not. So like the way that she sings "End" here, I feel like is like a pretty notorious like squeak, which I think is
totally
gorgeous.
Yes.
But that to me is sort of like, you again, like it sort of brings to mind like that like jolted like feeling that you might get from like being like all of a sudden I'm in this scene, like all of a sudden I'm remembering what's happening in this dream or whatever, like aware of what's happening in this dream. But you're right though, like the violins are still like do 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 do.
Yeah,
like they're nice. Yeah.
And as you say that too, it is like when, you know, that moment when you're dreaming, when you realize that you are dreaming and that you kind of do have some agency in your experience in the dream, that "and" is very much like that. Like you're not awake, but your mind is, like maybe our yeah. body's still sleeping, but
yep.
You're awake regardless. Your brain is moving.
Which I feel like might be relevant to like my sleeping heart woke and my waking heart spoke, which is coming up. But like in that same way, like if it is a lucid dream or something, like the way that she's sleeping and then like all of a sudden is like, oh, wait. Yeah. Like you said, I have agency, or like I am now aware of something I was not previously aware of.
Totally. This verse took me to some weird researching places. Like it's Tuesday morning at like 8 a.m. I have a cup of coffee and I was like researching World War II seaplanes. I won't say a lot about that other than like they exist. Could be used, like the black airplanes could be used as water bombers to fight fires. And I think that's only relevant in that fire moves away, fire moves away, sun are lines in the song. Yeah, but it took me
water bombers to fight fire.
Yeah, took me strange places, and the fact that they're flying over the sea. But if we're also thinking of this as like someone's experience with some kind of war, they're not shooting water. So,
right.
Yeah,
I love that you bring that up because this first fucking verse also brought me to some weird places, but instead of World War II, it took me to
beach
Japan,
whales,
16th and 19th century.
Amazing. And also we don't talk about this all week, like I don't think intentionally at all, but almost intentionally, like we don't really mention to each other what
you're researching. The specifics are
yeah okay, so what did you learn?
So because okay, again, I've said this sort of thing before, but like everything feels intentional with Gianna sometimes for me. And so when she says like black airplanes, I'm like, well, why are they black? That's a very specific reference to make. And black ships were a term that was commonly used by Japanese people to refer to Western vessels arriving in Japan. So they'd call them black ships. And I don't understand 16th and 19th century Japan politics at all. I have zero idea. Mm-hmm. But from what I very briefly read, black ships were a signal of like the end of self-imposed isolation. So Japanese people getting like the, I guess, opportunity to maybe, or just being forced to engage politically with the West in a way that they hadn't been previously.
Interesting.
And so, like, depending on the way that you're interpreting whatever violent or like warlike setting that we're in, it, like, the isolation part seems maybe relevant to me. I sort of tend to think kind of baselessly that the war imagery that's going on at the beginning of the song is maybe meant to make us think of like the war that can happen within one's own mind, maybe when you're mentally unwell.
Sure.
And that can often just be like a really lonely, isolated, self-imposed isolation time.
No, that's a really interesting connection. I did also see that like planes in World War II might have been painted or were painted black to, you know, be camouflaged at night. I really, the use of the word lowing here is really interesting too, of Germanic origin. And in the definition I found, it was compared to like the low bellowing of a cow, like a low and deep moan. So when you said like black ships, if you've ever heard, like there's tons of those really heavy, like carrier ships moving through Vancouver all of the time. And if the waves are really high, like really, really high, if it's a really bad stormy day, like you can almost hear like the really heavy weights on them shifting, and they very much moan.
Yeah, moan is a really good word for it. I don't live near water, nor have I ever lived near water, but the the thing that it makes me think of is like, I don't even know how to describe it, like a scene in Titanic, like when they start to sink.
Yes.
It's not like horns or anything, but like the ship itself was like, it's like so like moany.
It's like
sounding.
At the same time that the mini orchestra goes on to the deck when they've given up. Yeah. There with you.
You got it. Yeah. Holy shit, that's impressive. It's weird that we have the exact same memory of that sound.
That movie did come out. Like, I remember when Titanic came out and I was like, on like at Blockbuster, like on the list to get the double or triple VHS tape that came with a poster and a t-shirt.
Yes.
Like, I was right there with you.
I got that for Christmas one year. Oh, and I had posters.
So sweet.
I had posters of Leo DiCaprio all over my bedroom wall, and I would like do that thing where I would like kiss him.
Oh.
Like,
yeah.
Dude, I was into him.
Yeah,
as like a whatever. I don't know what year Titanic came out, but like I was little. Like we were like,
I feel like it was like 1999. I want to say,
yeah.
And also, right. I remember watching, this is totally off topic now, but watching like a documentary about Leonardo DiCaprio where, like, the teenage girl hosting the documentary went to like his school and found a piece of his gum under the desk and was like, oh, this could have been Leo's. And she eats it on the documentary.
Oh,
I know.
So
but at the
gross.
Same time thinking like, oh, like that could have been his. Like, wow.
I have such a vague memory of that I wonder if I'm like making up right now in my head or if you're just bringing to mind something I haven't thought of in like literally like 20 years or something.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay.
Oh, it came out in 1997. Okay. It came out in 1997.
97?
Yeah.
Man, we were young then. Little. I remember Titanic coming out, but
yeah.
Like that would have made me like 7 years old or like maybe 8 years old.
Yeah.
God, that's little.
It's little to be kissing posters on your wall, but that's what was sold to us. It's not our fault.
Totally. That's what was sold to us. Whatever.
Did you also, same Tuesday morning, same cup of coffee, just have such a heavy time researching beached whales?
I did not because I didn't actually look into beached whales at all. I just imagined their shifting motion and got really uncomfortable.
Yeah, fair. So the beached whale line really got me. And just the fact that it's a multiple beached whales, shelled snails.
Yeah.
So whales beach themselves for a few reasons, water temperature, their echolocation not working in certain spots, geomagnetic disturbances, and like the use of sonar as well. I also learned that Leonardo da Vinci was the first person ever to emulate sonar, which blows my mind.
That guy, seriously. Like, what?
I wrote in he my did notes, everything. What a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's insane, man.
But there's also this thing that happens that's especially tragic when larger whales are following smaller pods of dolphins or smaller species of whales called follow me strandings, where the larger whales are humming along, just kind of following behind the dolphins or the smaller whales. And because it's like tricky for their echolocation to bounce back to them properly near shorelines, like a gently curving slope of a coastline or a shoreline, the larger whales don't really realize what they're getting into, and they can accidentally get stuck in those shallow waters, whereas the smaller dolphins, I guess, can like wiggle themselves out easier. Also, like, aww, the strong,
so sad.
Yeah, man, I got lost in a hole. The strong social cohesion of tooth whale pods appears to be a key factor in many of these strandings. So if one gets into trouble, its intense calls of distress may prompt the rest of the pod to follow it and get stuck on the beach themselves. Like, this is a super rare event. It doesn't happen very often at all. And I know this is a super long shot, but like, I wonder if the narrator is making this connection to the kind of like group mentality of soldiers, of like the cavalry, like, we are in this together no matter what, be it a good decision or not. And if we're not talking like literally about soldiers, like you mentioned, if we're just being in our own heads, kind of like that inability to make right decisions or to distinguish what is left from right, what is right from wrong.
Yeah,
sad though.
It's so sad. So sad. A lot of what you said is super reminiscent of lines that are coming up, right? So even just the idea of like whales getting stuck at a shallow part. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the sand shoal that she's mentioning, yep, like actually in a couple lines, I think, mm-hmm, from here. But then there's also like the and the shallow water stretches knee deep. Mm-hmm. And I think shallow water is not a good thing for Joanna, yeah, or at least in this song. It's just it's an ominous I think I'm looking for the noun that corresponds with portend, to portend.
It doesn't give you much space, the shallow water.
Right,
you're stuck.
It's risky. It's hard to navigate.
It's hard to navigate. Right? Totally. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's so sad.
And then just with shelled snails, I was like, oh, like the idea that the cavalry desert doesn't wear protective gear, or that shelled means with or without protection, that they are very exposed. And if we're talking about, yeah, like being in your own head, like, to be able to communicate that to someone else is really exposing and really brave and really overwhelming.
Yeah.
And this repetition that will occur too of the hairless and blind cavalry, I think is important as well as we move through.
I think so too. So on the shelled part, shelled is one of the words, and of course I do not know the term for what I'm looking for, but some term refers to words that can mean both one thing and its opposite thing.
Yeah.
So shelled is one of those.
Yeah, I
and
yeah,
then like in inflammable, I think, is one of those too, or something like that. But where, yeah, like shelled could mean like it is a thing that is shelled.
Yeah.
Or it could mean something that has been shelled, as in like,
yes,
you know, plucked away from its shell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I came upon that too. And then just the idea to, and I forget where I read this, I'm sure it's coming up, that hairless and blind can literally just mean like the machines that are unmanned, in that they are literally without eyes and without hair.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because it feels like I was really obsessing kind of over like what the hairless and blind part refers to. Mm-hmm. And like, it the unmanned part is interesting because I don't know that she's referring to like literally unmanned planes that are like without people in them. Mm-hmm. But I think there is something to the idea that if they're blind, like she's not humanizing these other planes, right? So they're just machines to her, even though like that's probably not the case. It's probably not that there are airplanes that are just like droning their way into the song. But I mean, maybe. But yeah, hairless and blind. So cavalry obviously refers to like a like soldiers on horseback, right? Yeah. But here she's saying they're hairless and they're blind. So they're unlike horses in that they are hairless and they cannot see. So yeah, I was like, is it just the airplanes? Like what is the cavalry here? And you're right that it feels important because she repeats it.
What does hairless mean to you? Like, I was shocked that I could not find a definition as it meaning like without bravery, because to me it does. Oh. And I guess I just made that up. Apparently in British slang, it can mean like very angry or raging as well, which makes sense if we're talking about machines.
Yeah. To me, hairless just means without hair, but
interesting. For some reason in my brain, it also meant like to not be brave. But, you know, my brain could have just made that up too.
Yeah, but I like knowing what your brain is doing.
That's what this whole thing is about.
This whole thing is premised on. And also just like a very basic point that I wanted to bring up. I love the just, I feel like it took me about 7 years to like even like begin to imagine this imagery. But the, just the visual of the way that planes like sort of shift in the sky in the way that like a beached whale or a snail without its fucking shell might be like,
yeah,
it's like very distressing again. So it's, this is another song in which she starts with this very like distressing, uncomfortable, uneasy sense of this like imagery that just makes you feel off kilter, mm-hmm, right from the get-go.
And as you say that, it makes me think of the muscles beneath as well. We'll get there.
We'll get there. That part's crazy. It's all crazy. It's all fucking crazy.
The whole song is wild.
Really, 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 really is.
I did read that like the cavalry, the soldiers on horseback, were said to have had like this psychological impact on soldiers on foot because of their height and speed and mass. I just thought it was interesting to think of comparing these two sides as like whales versus horses, considering all the like comparing of contrasting in animals we've covered so far, like monkey and bear, but also like all of the pastoral animals hanging out with baboons and stuff. So.
Right. I mean, even just the idea that they're higher than, like, that the higher than-ness is imposing, that, like, given that this is a very dreamlike sequence, whether it is in fact a dream or if it is just sort of like a memory that she's, like, describing in this dreamlike quality, like, that kind of, like, symbolism or, like, just very, like, base psychological feeling that you might get from seeing something taller than you or higher than you, I think might factor in here, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. So why is he straining and squinting?
I assumed because it was nighttime. I assumed that as of yet we are in the middle of the night. And if we are like on the shore of the sea in the middle of the night, it's dark as fuck, and the only thing you can see is like the white tops of the waves. I'm assuming these planes, whatever they are, don't have lights because,
right,
you know, they're part of this battle that's happening.
Right.
That's what,
and they're black.
And they're black, exactly. And also, if there's soldiers on land, if the cavalry's on land, they also don't have lights. This also happens in a time frame that is not modern day in my mind. Like, this is something that's happening even like pre-World War I. I don't know. Like, in my brain, this is happening a long time ago. And these are not modern machines.
It's funny because in my mind, it's like, I don't mean timeless as in like it is just this like classical enduring piece of art, which it for sure is, but that's not what I mean here. I mean like I just don't in my mind. I just don't place it in a time. Like, it feels so dreamlike to me that I just don't, like, it feels like not removed from this world, because it's not, but just like, we're just like, I don't know, like entering this new story or something, or like being immersed in this like new, like, who the fuck knows what's going on at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you agree with that squinting part, or do you think it's strained and you squinted to see?
I hadn't thought of it until you said it. I like that though. That like, because it's dark, and also just darkness throughout, like Emily in particular, but then this song too, because she's like, something until the night is over. Hold on. So I feel like in both Emily and wherever that part is, the hold your horses back from the fickle dawn, like I feel like nighttime signifies something here because of that. Yeah. And it might be like being really immersed in whatever like drama maybe is happening with the you in this story, or maybe like in Emily for sure, it was like, well, I think for sure, I shouldn't say for sure about actually anything ever. So if I say that, please take that with a grain of salt. But like they were, you know, in due time, we'll see a fire butte lit by a flare, and like in the morning, she'll find her way back in. All that stuff. Like, it was just like darkness was very like just archetypically shit she had to get through.
Yeah. And as you say that too, it makes me wonder if like a lot of the sexuality in the song, a lot of the instances or in the narrator and the you are engaging in what we may or may not perceive as like a sexual act is happening solely in the nighttime. Like, I wonder if it is some kind of like traumatic time in the dark. And that like dreams themselves are traumatic, and like the sex is a way to avoid that, or kind of like
either
distract yourself, kind of exhaust yourself so the dreams don't come. I don't know.
Console yourself. Like, I think you're right that all those themes are present. I also just real quick, like making a very conscious effort to say something about music. I thought that like this part, I think this is like kind of what you were saying to you before, Sam, that this part of the song makes me think very much of like the music behind this part feels very dreamy and just sort of not distant exactly, but like whimsical and like happy. It doesn't feel like minor key. It feels more like lighthearted almost. Mm-hmm. Even though the stuff that she's describing, if it is in fact like a wartime kind of scenario that she's describing, which I think it is, just like if only like her use of the word cavalry here. But I think there are other indications too. That dark content contrasted with this sort of dreamy music makes it feel like a dream, maybe?
Yeah. No, I agree completely.
Did you read until up to the end of Hairless and Blind Cavalry? Or did you get to...
Yeah. Okay. So if you want to do the next verse, go for it.
Okay. So then she says, "You froze in your sand shoal, prayed for your poor soul. Sky was a bread roll, soaking in a milk bowl. And when the bread broke, fell in bricks of wet smoke. My sleeping heart woke and my waking heart spoke." I'll stop there because I feel like there's stuff to say. Yeah, so like one of the things I've written in my notebook here is like, well, why does the you here freeze? So the previous line that we ended with is, "As you strained and you squinted to see the retreat of their hairless and blind cavalry." So if this is, if the hairless and blind cavalry is a threat, and he's at least looking to see them retreat, are we supposed to imagine him as having seen them retreat? And then like, for some reason that made him freeze, maybe in like, in the way that like, I don't know even what situation I would have had this experience, but when you're scared of something and the thing goes away, you're like quiet for a minute still because you're like, is it actually gone? Right. Or can I exhale finally? Or is it like you froze because you're afraid of their having retreated, right? So it's not clear yet, at least, or ever to me. If we're supposed to imagine the cavalry of planes as being threatening or as being relief giving, I don't know.
And it with these lines, you froze in your sand shoal, at least in my mind, that places are you in the middle of the action. So spatially in my mind, it is like the cavalry on the land, the black airplanes over the sea. And we're right in the middle of that. Like a sand shoal is like a naturally submerged ridge, bank or bar in or beside a body of water. And is very much a place where like a boat or a whale might get stranded. But also yes. Like if you're in between these two, and in my mind, they are both kind of threatening forces, might be a safe place to be.
Right.
And in my mind, yeah, again, right. Like this you is kind of like an observer to whatever drama is about to unfold between the airplanes and the cavalry. And I agree with like the you frozen, you're central, like the freezing is like a response, like the fight, flight, freeze. It's not flight, fight, right. Freeze or anymore. They changed the language. I forget what it is now.
But I thought it was fight, flight, freeze, appease.
Could be. That could be the new one. Yeah, totally.
Not sure. All I know is that the appease part like speaks to me as a woman, like very much in particular, where I'm like, that is a fucking feminine response to threats, yeah. Is to like get the person on your side.
Yeah. Solve anyway. This problem with sweetness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By sweet with sweetness, mm-hmm. Exactly. And actually, like, that's not irrelevant to the themes throughout the song.
Oh, holy shit, is it not?
Yeah.
It is relevant.
Shit comes up. Yeah. And like she explicitly says, you know, being a woman, mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. What I do to you, what it is I do to you to keep you warm being a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm interested in your having said that it positions this person, the you here, as an observer of all of it. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I hadn't actually quite considered like what exactly his role is. I think maybe my like unexamined assumption was just that he is a like maybe soldier in the middle of war, and in that case he's like somewhat maybe of a participant, but it really, I mean, there's no indication yet that he's like holding a gun or anything, right? Like you're right that like the sand shoal is the one shallow part in, although also with the sand shoal I was confused because when I looked up the definition it was like it's submerged, and I was like, well, how is he in it then? He needs to breathe.
I mean, it brings me to that line that is upcoming where she's like wading through the shallow water. And I think that's probably why my mind placed them. Like, I think even if our narrator isn't with, I'm assuming it's a him. I know we've said he and him. This is an assumption we're making. Who the fuck knows? They,
them, who the fuck knows? She, pretty sure it's a him.
Yeah. Yeah, and even if she is, even if the narrator is not in the dream, she kind of is.
I know. Yeah, the access that she has to these images is curious to me. Yeah, and like whose dream is it? It could be her dream.
Could very well be. Yeah.
Could be his dream. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I was reading a little bit further on when she said, like, and darling, it was a dark dream, darling, it's over. Mm-hmm. That made me then at least think, like, well, it's his dream that he was having. All this shit that we're talking about right now is his dream. But you're right that, like, this narrator has this access to it such that maybe it's not. It could be that he just told her about it, but it also could be that it's her dream.
The next one is prayed for your poor soul. I assumed this to mean that, and I wrote they, and now I question that. Because in my mind, they're together in this. And like, and you're right, maybe it is that he's just amazing at explaining these dreams to her when they wake up. And I just assumed this prayed for your poor soul to mean that they can see whatever threat is approaching.
Right.
Either be it the airplanes, the cavalry. And then I was confused, are they in the middle of this action? Again, assuming that the airplanes are approaching from the sea and the cavalry is on land and they're kind of like in the middle of that.
I thought the cavalry was the planes. I'm not at all confident. I spent actually like a stupid amount of time trying to figure this shit out. But in my head, the cavalry, because like the reason that the cavalry is hairless and blind is because it's just planes. It's not horses. I hadn't thought though of the idea that it could be that like they're actually being like whatever confronted on all sides.
Yeah, like sandwiched between them.
Right.
And then it makes me wonder if they are one in the same. Not only like what is the threat, but like how you plays into it.
Yes.
Like, is you the target of this threat? Is you an observer to this as just like an event?
Or like a participant in the threat too.
And a participant in what way? Oh,
Actually, you know what? I actually think the latter. So I think that maybe that the you here might be a participant because, sorry to jump ahead, but at the, like in like a verse and a half, she says, while you're left to explain them to me, released from their hairless and blind cavalry. And in my head, it was that he has been released from the cavalry. I mean, actually, that could be like released from the threat of the cavalry, or it could be released from like the military service or whatever. Like the
yeah, and in my mind, that one was like released from the threat of the dream or like from the memory.
Right. Yeah. Okay, that could be it. Who the fuck knows?
This combination of words here is like some of my favorite in all of her music. The sky was a bread roll soaking in a milk bowl, and when the bread broke, fell in bricks of wet smoke.
Me too.
I had assumed that this was, if we are in this scene in the middle of the night, that this was just kind of like an incredibly vivid way to describe like the coming of dawn and the like milky, dimly lit skies contrasted with like the barely glowing sun. And also the idea that like the sky is getting soggy, like maybe wet with dew or morning rain. And then the bread breaking is like the sun rising. The destruction of the night battle is either visible or the battle is beginning.
Right.
And I'm doing it like the motion of the bread breaking to myself.
To me.
Yeah. I did it to myself often too. Is it like the clouds parting? Is it like those clouds giving way to either like the smoke from the violence of the cavalry, or like that the heaviness of the evening or the dream is giving way to the violence of the morning or the smoke from the guns or weapons, whatever is clearing. I don't know either,
but I love that you made me think of morning here. Cause for some reason that just didn't occur to me, but given that like later she's like telling him to hold his horses back from the fickle dawn, she's like wanting to stay in the night, even though the night seems like a dangerous and imposing place. Like it could be that the morning is threatening in this way. Where like the sky's breaking. Mm-hmm. It's funny now because the words wet smoke separated look weird to me.
Yeah.
My username on fucking everything is just wet smoke as one word, obviously. I know, like it looks misspelled. But yeah, so I was reading a little bit about this today, and another interpretation I saw was that it is sort of describing an explosion, kind of.
Yes.
So if like the sky was a bread roll soaking in a milk bowl, and then like the bread breaks, so like some event happens, and then like almost like pieces of this like blotted out bread smoke start to fall into like our world, right? Start to fall from the sky to the ground. Yeah, it's hard to know exactly how to picture it, but I also just love the combination, just phonetically, the way that it sounds.
Oh, it's so cool.
It's really cool. And then also I hadn't thought of this until today when I was doing some research, but I'm curious as to whether she is using bread broke here in the way that she like sings it, like, should we break some bread on Thursday?
Yeah.
So to break bread, right, just means to, I guess, come together. And it, just like going down my little rabbit hole theories, like tinfoil hat theories. If she was referring to the black ships that the Japanese, or the way the Japanese people used to call American ships, black ships, and that was supposed to symbolize the end of isolation, that like if she's bringing to mind here, making us think of bread breaking, maybe it's like coming together in a way that is like a solace from the isolation that preceded.
I love that. And then my next question would be like, is that happening in the morning or in the evening? Like, is this post dream? Is this in the middle of the night? Right. Is she like waking him up? Is she like shaking him out of it? And then as we were talking, do you know the story? The sky is falling.
Yes, Chicken Little.
Yeah, Chicken Little.
Yeah.
And I hadn't made that connection until now either, but like the sky is falling as an idiom just means like disaster is imminent.
When it's not actually though, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So that's cool, Sam, because I feel like way ahead, but the scrape your knee, it's only skin line is, I mean, there's like a trillion different interpretations I found about that line, but one of them at least is like, look, you're making a big deal out of something when it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And that's the exact like moral of the story or whatever of Chicken Little, right? Or does it turn out the sky's actually falling? And
I don't
think
it is. I don't think so.
I don't remember. All I remember is like, the sky is falling. The sky is falling.
Yeah. I'll look it up on Wikipedia as we keep talking here. Henny Penny. Oh, why did they name Henny Penny Chicken Lickin'? This story goes back 25 centuries.
What?
Jesus Christ.
Oh my God. That's way older than I thought. I would have guessed like the 70s, 1970s.
Yeah, so the sky is falling have been applied to people accused of being unreasonably afraid or those trying to incite an unreasonable fear in those around them.
Right.
Wow. Was first used in 1840. Huh.
Huh is right.
That's... Fear-mongering, whether justified or not, can elicit a societal response called Chicken Little Syndrome, described as inferring catastrophic conclusions, possibly resulting in paralysis, froze in your sand shoal.
Oh, shit, man. Yeah. Whoa, that's crazy.
And maybe like, not.
This is not that much. No, totally maybe not. But like, also just to like give credence to this theory, it's not that much of a stretch because she's not. We're not just being like, ooh, there's like sky allusions here. Like she literally says sky was a bread roll.
Yeah.
And then the bread falls from the sky, right?
That's
or the bread falls
cool.
in. Cool. It is really cool. I was talking to my partner and I was like, man, like I have such a better understanding of the songs after we talk to each other.
Yeah.
And like, it's not even just like this, like, it's like this like process that we go through together for some reason. And it just helps. Like we're greater than the sum of our parts, Sam.
Oh, very much so. I feel like I'm wildin' when I do this research by myself. Like I feel like I'm just pulling these invisible strings around me that are tied to nothing and there's no conclusion. But then you just reinforce all of these thoughts and it's really fun.
It's so much fun. I love doing this.
It's fantastic.
God. Okay, so another note that I had, and I'm so proud of myself for like knowing this word because I had to look it up like 17 times.
I thought you were
going to
say knowing
remembered.
The source, and I was like, wow, Nikki.
No, no. I don't know the source. My head somewhere, whatever. But I also didn't know how to pronounce this word for the record. I know how to spell it, but it looks like it's spelled synecdoche. But it's actually synecdoche, I think.
Synecdoche
is a city in upstate New York. It's very close to where I live. But synecdoche, I think, is I think it's a literary term. And it's supposed to mean, I think, when a part of something represents the whole of something. And so I feel like Joanna does this a lot, where she like invokes in particular the heart, and the heart is supposed to represent more than just like her. It's not just a metaphor for her like heart. I think it's supposed to be like a metaphor for herself, or maybe her consciousness, or like her conscious, maybe, like, I don't know. But yeah, like, so I guess my question here was like, what does, there are a bunch of different ways we could think of her sleeping heart waking up. And then also a bunch of different ways we could think of her waking heart as speaking. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're supposed to think like, okay, she woke up from the dream, or maybe like he woke up from the dream and so did she because of him. Or maybe just like this way more metaphorical way of thinking about it, which is like this part of me that was like lying dormant kind of has come back into being, and I'm ready to like, I don't know if you've ever been like in a relationship. Like there's this one relationship in particular that I can so picture just like this weird autopilot that I was on. And then like just for no good reason, like one day just being like, nope, like that's done now. Like I have to confront this, like, so like this like sleeping part of myself just like came to be, and it was like, no, actually this part's been bugging me for a real long time. Mm-hmm. If we're supposed to think of it like that, or like what exactly is waking up here and what exactly is speaking here? Is it literal speaking, or is it speaking to her? Is it speaking to him, to the both of them? I don't know.
Yeah. I had written like, at this point, I feel either the narrator realizes that, so either we are waking from this dream, and the narrator either in reiterating this dream to, no, sorry, the you in reiterating this dream to the narrator realizes that now they are visible, now they are exposed, and any like cover that the night provided, any cover the night provided them is now dissipated. Or maybe they hadn't allowed themselves to feel strongly for either side or feel at all. Maybe the dark, like I'm assuming my sleeping heart woke is them like literally waking up. Him literally waking up, either waking up in bed from the dream, or like you said, waking up within your own self to realize something that you had been either pretending not to see or just not able to see. And was the dark like something that hid the violence? And now that waking heart is either allowing them to feel, telling them to move, telling them to listen. Right. I don't know.
I feel like I might have like dichotomized that in a way that is not necessary, particularly for Joanna Newsom songs, where it could be that thing that we were talking about at some point in the last episode, or, you know, for us, the last episode, like as in the last time we recorded, it could be in the last three for you guys, who the hell knows where it comes up. But we were talking about polysemy. I don't know how to pronounce it still. Mm-hmm. Polysemy. Mm-hmm. Where it's supposed to be like the deliberate way in which an author can make one word mean a multiple of different things. Mm-hmm. And so here it could mean she could be trying to convey that both she wakes up from whatever dream she's in, or he does, or whatever. And that like this part that was dormant inside of her is coming to the surface. I feel like it shouldn't be a dichotomy where we have to choose between one or the other. Mm-hmm.
But the waking heart is saying something. Is the waking heart saying the next verse?
Well, man, I had question marks all over this part, because the next verse, she... Okay, so about the thought that the thing that her heart says might occur in the next verse, I was super curious about this, because the next verse, she starts with... Actually, do you want to read the next verse, Sam?
Sure. The next one is, Then there was a silence you took to mean something. Mean, run, sing. And this part is in italics as well. So the part in italics is italicized. Run, sing, for alive you will evermore be. And the plague of the greasy black engines, a skulking has gone east. And then the italics are finished. While you're left, you explain them to me, released from their hairless and blind cavalry.
Right. Okay. So I have like a million things to say here. Mm-hmm. But the first thing is that it starts with, right after she says, my waking heart spoke, she says, then there was a silence you took to mean something. So this, I don't know, maybe makes me think that the thing that her heart says is to herself and not actually out loud to him. I mean, also the silence that she's referring to could just be like a silence that she, like that comes after the thing that she says, but like he draws meaning from this silence. So whatever the silence is, he's taking meaning from it. Mm-hmm. And what, regardless of whether she said something or she just said something to herself, like whether she said something out loud or she said something to herself, there's a silence after that. And we don't get his response to whatever she said.
And I just had to look back in the lyrics because you froze in your sand shoal. I had assumed a silence there as well. So I was like, is there a callback to, is the narrator saying like, you took something that wasn't there, like this silence that you felt in the dream. There's no meaning in that. But I think that was something I had assumed as we went through. It's not in the actual lyrics. So
for the silence part, she says, then there was a silence you took to mean something. Mm-hmm. However, though, like all of our like verses here, not all of them, but a whole bunch of our verses here are totally out of order. So like we are thrown in and out of
time frames
and context. So that doesn't necessarily mean we should take this as like a literal chronological order.
No, that's a good point. This song, I feel like unlike Monkey and Bear, and I can't say for sure Sawdust Diamonds, but at least unlike Monkey and Bear, there is less of like a straight line, less of a really clear timeline.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's so in and out, and like you get just like discombobulated trying to like even from the get-go, the starting the song with the end gets you in that mind frame where you're like, where are we? Like, I'm still trying to like flounder around and find my way.
Floundering is a really good word for this entire song, certainly. Yeah.
It's the feeling it gives. Actually, also, I had meant to ask you about the prayed for line in the previous verse. Mm. So who is the person doing the praying here, do you think? I always took it, but I don't know, now that you said like maybe it's a dream where she is present. But I always took it to be like that he prayed for his poor soul.
Yeah, that's what I had assumed as well. Something about in being case, in the dark dream.
Yes, and also feeling sorry for himself in a way that also might get
scrape your knee, it's only skin.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So this is like the beginning of him sort of self-pitying. And interestingly, it's not like self-pitying can be like in two different ways. It can be self-pitying in a way where like, yeah, you should feel bad for yourself because whatever you're going through is horrible. Mm-hmm. Or it can be you're pitying yourself in a way that's, you know, unwarranted and like self-indulgent.
Yeah.
And it's just totally ambiguous here what's happening. Yeah, and I guess it could be her praying for him too. Although the tense just is like the you froze in your sand shoal, prayed for your poor soul. She doesn't ever say I.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she doesn't insert herself in that. And again, I just want to say we're assuming the genders of all of these characters. I think this is something
honestly, like
our experiences have probably colored this differently than other people might, and that's totally cool.
I 100% want to stand by that. And like, it is not, we're not necessarily right about that or about anything else we say for that matter. Yep. But like, there is, there's a certain like, I want to be really careful with what I say here, like a certain maleness to the you in this story, in the same way as there was a certain maleness to the monkey that yes. I think she's trying to bring our attention to, especially because she says stuff like being a woman. And of mm-hmm. course, people can be women in the company of people who are not women, whether they're like non-binary or men or other women. But I feel like there is something to the Blessing All the Birds posts where there's this binary happening throughout the song. There's like this push and pull of these like opposite, which are in quotation marks mm-hmm. or is in quotation marks, these opposite forces throughout the song sort of pulling and pushing against each other.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And like the later on, like the slut shaming of the narrator and a lot of like the manipulation and emotional ridicule, I agree with you, has a certain male energy, masculine energy to it.
There are gender dynamics happening yes. within the song. Yes. yes. Yeah. Also, this is one of the times. So, okay, I wanted to reference here a wonderful site. I don't know. I have no idea who is the creator of this site, but it is called JoannaNewsomeLyrics.com.
Yeah, I use that all the time.
It's awesome. It is just a catalog of all of her lyrics as they're written, and all of the songs, the written lyrics are contrasted with the way that she sings it. Yeah. And here's one of the parts where they deviate. So the written lyrics, and I like double checked this in my little lyric booklet, she writes, "There was a silence you took to mean something, colon, mm-hmm. mean, comma, italics, run, sing." And then, as Sam said, the italics go on for longer than I thought they did. They go on. So like, I assume the italics are indicating that this is the thing that the guy took it to mean, or the person took it to mean, right? So mm-hmm. There was science you took to mean something, mean, italics, run, sing, for alive you will evermore be, and the plague of the greasy black engines, a skulking has gone east. So all of that's in italics. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, so, and then when she sings it, she does not say mean. So she says, there was a silence you took to mean something, run, sing. So the mean here, I feel like, brings a clarity that I didn't have before in just listening to the song part, because it wasn't clear to me whether it was that the silence that he took to mean something, the meaning of that silence was run, sing, mm-hmm. or whether she was saying that to him. There was a silence he took to mean something, and then like separate thought, I am saying run, sing, for alive you will evermore be. Mm-hmm. But it's the former. So it's that the thing that it took it to mean, that he took it to mean, was run, sing, for alive you will evermore be, and the plague of the greasy black angel and the skulking has gone east. So is the silence the thing that her, that comes after her heart having woken up? Is the silence the like the background to his frozenness in his sensual?
Is it them like waking up in bed beside each other? I want to say her in kind of like a slow, sleepy way, and maybe him like as we are introduced to the song with this conjunction of and this this quite high note. No, that's a great question. And that's very true. Like, if I hadn't read the lyrics as they are contrasted on the Joanna Newsom Lyrics website compared to the vinyl copy that I have, I probably wouldn't have noticed that.
Yeah. The even just stuff like the punctuation mm-hmm. in the like the lyric booklet helped me a lot.
Yeah.
With her songs. And I had a note here that so like whatever it is that we take the silence to be, and like why we take it to be the case that it means something to him, or that it means this particular thing to him. One thing I noted was that the for a lot. So I guess, okay, sorry, backing up for a second. The idea of saying like this thing meant to me that I should run sing because I'll be alive forever mm-hmm. is like this sort of first poking at pleasure, like, right, like embrace things or like, you know, do what you want to do because like you're safe, you're gonna be alive, like it's good. But I thought that this, knowing the whole song is a tiny bit creepy, like the alive you will evermore be part contrasts with the like we're thundering blissful towards death mm-hmm. part. Mm-hmm. Cause like we're not gonna be alive forever.
This one I took as a joke. For alive you will evermore be as like, no, you won't.
That's not happening.
Like, no. If we're thinking about this, and we are slowly introducing like the more sexual aspects of this song. And if this is in reference to like someone maybe who just had an orgasm, like that feeling of immense pleasure right yeah. after like, fuck yeah, we'll be alive forever. This is great. Like, what a fucking joke.
Nothing else matters in this
yeah,
moment.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a way better interpretation than I have.
I wouldn't say right better. It just made me lol and think about joy, yeah. landlocked and all of it. Yes. Like,
yes.
No, yeah. you won't. And like the specific word choice of evermore, I also think is yeah, yeah. hilarious.
It makes me think of Poe.
Yeah.
Evermore. Yeah. Or nevermore, I guess is his thing. But yeah. No, I think that's a better interpretation because like, yeah, of course. I mean, unless the other thing that I was thinking is that like maybe there's some sort of like religious like holy experience that he had here sure. which is like now I believe in heaven mm-hmm. but that feels too literal or like clumsy or something. I'm not sure. I don't know. Yeah.
So I had written I felt like with this verse either the dream is over, our narrator and partner have awoken either back in the real world or awoken as if this entire battle was a dream and now is there a chance to escape? But also, like, if we are back in this dreamland, it's like the you realizing that daylight has come, the plagues of the greasy black engines, a skulking have gone east. East is where the sun rises. If the sun is up, like, we survived. You have made it through this harrowing experience alive. The plague has moved on. Like the trauma of the night has passed and maybe the you here is able to kind of explain their experience to the narrator. And then like there's the repetition of the hairless and blind cavalry.
Yeah. I think that without knowing it even, but I think that maybe the you're left to explain them to me, explain the plague of the greasy black engines, or just maybe the greasy black engines themselves, maybe is the thing that made me think that she wasn't privy to whatever it is that he was experiencing. Yeah. And if it is all just like allegory for mental illness and, you know, like the demons that you fight within yourself, that it would make sense that she can picture exactly what it's like because, you know, each of us have our own shit that we have to deal with mentally, but mm-hmm. That like she doesn't know exactly and like he's left to try to
pick up the pieces of wet bread that are left and like yeah, right. try and mold them back together into something she can understand.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And to even, yeah, exactly like what you said, like to just like this very basic level, not even doing anything about it, but just understanding the thing that he has been through. Mm-hmm. Or like he's going to try to explain it to her at least, I think. Yeah. And then again, like, so the punctuation here is so like when, while you're left to explain them to me, hyphen, released from their hairless and blind cavalry. Mm.
Past tense.
Right. You've been released from their hairless and blind cavalry. And again, like we had talked about before, it could be that he was released from having to be the soldier or just released from the threat. Yeah.
I just have a note here for skulking. And just the idea that these like engines of war if that is ever what we're talking about, are like skulking their responsibilities to the greater humanness. We talked a lot in Sawdust and Diamonds about like the imagery of the bell, the idea that a bell tolls for each one of us. The line that I remembered from then was, "Each man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind." And to like engage in such direct violence as to engage in war is to very much break that contract with mankind. And also just like the visual of him skulking, shrugging off, like coming to from this dream and like trying to get it off of his shoulders. Yeah.
So I looked up skulking, and this is not something that I would have thought naturally, because I think you're right that like the skulking part of like the shaking something off is something that I would have like something that like the word brings to mind. Mm-hmm. But I looked up skulking and it said something like, so these are just based on my paltry notes, but to keep out of sight, typically a cowardly or sinister motive. So with, I guess, a cowardly or sinister motive. So when you were talking before, Sam, about the way that like when he's straining and he's squinting to see the cavalry, that like they are concealed maybe because it's nighttime and maybe because they're black machines in the sky, right? So they're like creeping and sneaking along, but they've gone away now. They've retreated.
And if we are thinking that he was part of the cavalry as well, that maybe he himself had like skulked, had like shifted from the group responsibility to engage in this and had chosen to hide instead, which is something I hadn't considered, which is totally noble. Do it.
Don't fight for
no.
There's like a term for that. Is it like deserter or something? I think there's like conscientious deserting too. I don't know. I shouldn't speak out of turn. Serial part two or season two, I think, was about like a perhaps conscientious deserter, maybe. I know that you've listened to that sound.
I think I have. Yeah.
Bo something. Anyway, so I didn't think of that either, that it could just be that he decided to not fight. It like it's also kind of interesting because I think in Have One on Me and for sure in Divers, she has this like, again, like kind of like binary-y dynamic happening between the East and the West. So think to Goose Eggs, where she says like West or East. And then just in Have One on Me, she says like, where is it? In, I think, Go Long, she has like a bunch of Eastern themes. And so it could be that like the East has gone back to, and like also, so sorry, just even domestically, she's from the West. So she's from the West on a global scale. Mm-hmm. And then also domestically, she's from California. And so she's very much, I feel like, maybe associating herself with the West, and the East is sort of this like, if not threat, then at least just foreign.
Something different, the opposite side.
Something different.
That dichotomy again, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if the cavalry has gone east, I'm wondering if it's that they're going back home and this like Western front maybe is intact still or something. I'm not sure.
And again, like it doesn't have to be, I know we keep talking about these images of literal war, but it doesn't have to be that either. It could be like we've said a zillion times, like the fighting of your own traumas, the fighting of your own, of your own needs, of your own,
like anything.
Anything.
Like even just like, anything. It could be like a disagreement you've had with another person or like a battle of yourself against yourself in countless different ways. Yeah, you're right. We shouldn't get too stuck on the literal like warness, because we're not talking about a literal war, I'm pretty sure.
Not on this podcast.
Not on this podcast.
Are you ready for the next verse?
I believe that I am, even though this next verse, like, I have 20,000 question marks, I think, next to you. But okay, let me just, so, with your hands in your pockets, stubbly running to where I'm unfresh, undressed, and yawning, Well, what is this craziness, this crazy talking? You caught some small death when you were sleepwalking.
So this verse, I feel like if my theory is this is all a dream, I should sit closer to the mic. If my theory is that this is all a dream and she is waking up and like she's, you know, he's snapped awake. She has woken up and is kind of like, the fuck are you talking about? Like she's kind of in this like half asleep, confused.
I was not part of that dream. Like
I wasn't there with you. Yeah. What is going on?
What is this craziness? What is this crazy talking? Yeah.
It was in one of the Blessing of the Birds articles that I read that to catch some small death is like an archaic, and of course it's an archaic idiom because it's Joanna Newsom, an archaic French idiom for an orgasm.
Yes, la petite mort.
Yes, exactly.
La petite mort is like a popular way of saying like orgasm. It's like, it's such a cool comparison. You just like die a little bit.
Yeah. Genius. It was on Genius that I read that it's a euphemism for an orgasm that refers to like the unconscious state that befalls some people after experiencing one. And whoever had written this citation had said the man half awake during the night, perhaps the result of a nightmare, and made love to the narrator in a daze, which I don't necessarily believe that one. I don't necessarily agree with that.
But you don't have to, yeah, to think that la petite mort is significant. Yeah, I really love this small death part. Mm-hmm. Although, like, I have to say, just as a sort of disclaimer, I guess, pretty much every single thing on Genius that suggests that maybe there's like a sexual connotation in this song is like downvoted, like more than things are upvoted on it. Like people are like, that. No. People do not like this interpretation. And like, I get thinking it's not all about sex because it's not all about sex.
I mean, it's like the last,
really, really think.
It's like the last episode where I was like, we can't with the abortion on this. We can't.
Right. Just make it about that.
Yes.
It can be there and present in the song, but there's a whole bunch of other layers of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I think that that is exactly right. That like a mistake you would make with this song is thinking it's only about sex and like desire and sexual illusions or whatever, but it's not. It's about this whole entire relationship, and encompassed in that is this sexual element.
I noted here just like this is the first reference of hands in your pockets or looking through your pockets for something, which will be repeated here as well. And I just noted like, is the pockets here a reference to the upcoming mention of Sisyphus, who we're not going to talk about today, but it will come. I know it's a big one. If you want to, we can.
No, it's okay. It's okay. We can wait, I think, unless it comes up. But and I know exactly what you're talking about. So like scrap a sassafras, a Sisyphus.
Yeah. And is the
picking through your pocket lining.
Exactly. Picking through. Yeah. And is the you're here looking for something, something they're not getting from the narrator, or something they need to interpret from the dream? Are they looking for sympathy from this assumed female character for like the night that they've just had?
Yeah.
Or is this like... running to the narrator's location is shameful, is in some way that they need to hide their intention.
Right. So a couple of things about this. So my first very just like not super insightful point at all is just like picture the way that your shoulders kind of go up when you put your hands in your pockets. Like, mm-hmm, it's a little higher than your arms would normally fall. And that makes your shoulders kind of go up and makes you have like either a shruggy look to you, mm-hmm, like, meh, or a kind of like shy and like, as you said, Sam, like repressed kind of look.
Yeah.
And then in that same interview, as we talked about in some episode about Emily, either one or two, in that Guardian interview where she's talking about the way that she took like the Nabokov reference, mm-hmm, in that same very part, she says, like, I felt two characters that in my head had life to them. They were so finely drawn that they became archetypal. Jason Compson in The Sound and the Fury, running with his hands in his pockets, foreshadowing greed and repression. So, I mean, she's pretty much explicitly telling us there that, like, look, we're both supposed to imagine this character as being repressed and as being greedy. He wants something.
So he wakes up from this dream and immediately heads straight to her, her who is, in my mind, still in bed, unfresh, undressed, and yawning. So she's not prepared for his arrival in any way. In my mind, he's also...
And, like, not on the same page, right? Like,
very much not. Like, in my mind, you know, I'm picturing her, right? So it's, like, this elaborate bed. She's sitting there, you know, like, in this beautiful, like, nightgown or something. Hasn't had a cup of coffee. Hasn't brushed her teeth. And this guy walks in, hands in his pockets, and is like, oh, had a really rough night. Like, the black airplanes and the sea and the cavalry, man. And she's just, like...
What is this craziness?
Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot.
I very much get that. And just the idea of him coming to her for comfort, for needing this, like, in this way that to me, and this is controversial, it's fine. I very much could be wrong. In this way that sounds super sexual to me, with, like... Stubbly running to where I'm unfresh always made me think of, like, a hand. I'm, like, showing Sam, like, doing this, like, down to, like, sexual areas, where you're unfresh, right? Like, you're not showered and, like, I don't know.
She's
I can just very much picture that feeling.
Too. So she's not undressed. Expecting it. She's not.
In that frame of mind at all.
And she's exposed as well if she's undressed and unfresh.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Where it's like, I'm vulnerable right now, and what you want from me is possibly sex, possibly just comfort. But yeah, I think maybe just keep in mind here, like, there's not an explicitly sexual thing. You could very much interpret the to where I'm unfresh, undressed, and yawning part as being a sexual thing. But if you don't, maybe just note that there, like, are potentially sexual things to come. And so I think very much that a theme throughout this song is this idea of this person who I think is a man, or who I've always thought of as a man, as seeking comfort or distraction, maybe, in these sexual dynamics between the two people, and in ways that can be really destructive and shitty, or even just pleasure seeking.
Yeah.
But yeah, do you take this to be a sexual part, Sam, or do you just think that it's like, yeah, like what, like you said, just like not ready for for whatever plane he's on?
I will say this, that the idea that this is a song about sex did not occur to me for a long time. Like, all of the pleasure in this song was in the singing along and the ups and downs and the, like, going along on this wild, winding journey with the characters. And the idea that all of it is based on sex is something that I hadn't fully considered until a lot more recently. I just, like, with any of her other songs, like we said, like, I'm not 100%, I don't buy in that it's only about that, but it's here and it's there. I think it's a lot more present than, like, a much younger me listening to Joanna Newsom would have, been ready to admit, for sure.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel with it too. I did not pick up on the sex stuff early on in my only skin years. But now, like, it does, like, there's just this, like, nuance that I think is, like, a part of, I don't know, maturing, maybe, that, like,
yeah,
these references can be there while the song is about something entirely different. So just it bringing to mind sex stuff is, like, maybe enough. It doesn't have to go any further than that, other than, like, this is a part of a relationship.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there is, like, some kind of, maybe, I don't know if transactional is the right word for it, but some kind of exchange dynamics where it's like, she is aware that she can do this thing that will soothe him.
Yes.
And it legit has this effect of soothing yes. him that is maybe not a great feeling. And just as women, I feel like that's not an uncommon feeling to have, which is that, like, I know what you want. I could just give in or I could not. But there's like a price. There's a price of just succumbing to that pressure.
Very much
so. Which is not at all to slut shame. Like, I don't mean that at all. It's just to say that, like, when you're doing it in this transactional way, I'm going to give you this so that you can feel better, or that's it, you can stop freaking out about your fucking war dream.
Yeah.
you know, there's a cost to that.
And also, like, the awareness or lack of awareness that he has in this role. Mm-hmm. Like, does he know what he's doing? I want to assume he yes. does. I want to assume that he knows exactly what the fuck he is doing at every single step. And maybe she does too, but that doesn't make it easy or right or wrong or any right. of those things.
Right. I am so much, I mean, maybe this is just like a very personal bias. I am so much less willing to blame her for being willing and like knowing of what's going
on.
But
it's just like we were with Monkey and Bear, right? Like, we're not going to buy into the fact that that Monkey doesn't know what he's doing this entire time. He's getting her to dance for his own needs, for his own monetary desire, right? Like, it's not, yeah, I am also much more willing to believe our narrator.
And just like, I'm just much more sympathetic to the idea that she's doing this, being like, yeah, okay, if you're going to stop fucking having a tantrum about it, like, I'll just give in, which sucks. That's not like the way that sex ought to happen, mm-hmm. probably, unless whatever, like, consent is obviously really important. And there's like a question of how much consent there is if someone is just pressuring you a whole bunch into having sex. But like, I don't even know if manipulation is certainly happening here. Well, I think certainly. But I don't know if it's a kind of in the same way with Monkey, actually. I don't know if it's like a central part of this song where, like, we don't really need to know, nor are we given many clues as to whether it's intentional or not. We can think like, yeah, come on. Like, this is the way that that manipulation often happens, whether it's with Monkey or the you in this song. But also you might think like, yeah, like, it's just the way that people are socialized to interact with each other. Men are socialized to like be like, no, all sex
yeah.
from women all the time. And women are like traditionally and stereotypically seen as like the gatekeepers of this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, I don't know. I just, whatever's going on here, it brings to mind at least that kind of dynamic, or at least the beginnings of that kind of dynamic to me.
Yeah, very much so. Do you have more comments about this verse?
One more just quick note. Mm-hmm. Just, I forget if this was on Genius or elsewhere, but I just want to note, like, some of the sex stuff that is posted on Genius gets, like, ridiculously explicit to the point where I'm like, that is just not what's happening. Like, there was some point where someone was talking about like the cherry pit, and they were like, notice how the wrinkles in the cherry pit resemble women's vulvas. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think that's what she was referring to, but whatever. Maybe. But anyways, the sleepwalking part, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to make fun of anybody, but this just, to me, this is like far from where my mind was at. But the interpretation I had seen was like, someone was like, yeah, like, the guy nutted himself while he was sleeping, and now she's like awaking to deal with this. And I was like, I don't think it has to be that literal. I don't think it has to have come while he was sleeping and now she's dealing with the consequences. I think it's just more subtle and nuanced than that, like, literal very vulgar interpretation.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you as well.
All right, I think that's all I have to say. I mean, I guess there's still the question though of what the sleepwalking part mm-hmm. is. So was he sleepwalking while he was dreaming, and like, did that have real world consequences for her?
Oh, that's a great question.
I don't know. I don't know.
That's a really good question. I hadn't considered that before.
And I mean, are we talking about a literal dream, or are we talking about like, while you were going through this mental health stuff, there were consequences as well, that like, yeah, that occurred as a result of you having been like really immersed in your the demons in your head, right? Like the stuff that you've been fighting.
No, that's really interesting.
Okay, guys, so this is going to mark the end of our first part on Only Skin, the first of God knows how many parts. I, again, of course, fucked up the audio for the outro, so it's just me, but I promise I'll fix this soon-ish. Anyways, so we hope you guys enjoyed part one. Please feel free to send us any thoughts you have about the entire song, or any of the previous songs or all of East. Also, we're getting to have one on me. So pretty much like if you have any thoughts, just send them our way. Our email is ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com. Endeavor is spelled E-N-D-E-A-V-O-R. We have a Facebook group run by me, which is A Hopeless Endeavor, the Joanna Newsom podcast. Sam runs our Instagram group, which is, I think, A Hopeless Endeavor podcast. For some reason, I can never remember that one. Neither can she, but it's something like that. So go follow us there. We actually have some kind of exciting news. We think we're going to be coming out with a Patreon soon, so keep your eyes open for that. And yeah, just thank you guys so much for listening, sincerely from the bottom of our hearts. In particular, like, we are grateful for your having listened to this episode, because as Sam and I said at the beginning, it's just an episode that's like really close to our hearts. It means a lot to us, and it's really cool to be able to share our obsession with you all. So thank you guys so much for listening. We will see you next Saturday with part two of Only Skin. Bye.